welcome to RightsCast. This special episode features a discussion around Dr. Hedy Vijbrov's latest book, Problematizing Law, Rights, and Childhood in Israel-Palestine. Commentators include Alexandra Cox, a senior lecturer at the University of Essex Department of Sociology, Mariam Jamshidi, an assistant professor at law at the University of Florida Levin College of Law, and Yael Ronan, professor of law at the Academic Center for Science and Law at Had HaSharon and the Minerva Center for Human Rights at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. The book launch was organized by Dr. Haim Abraham from the University of Essex School of Law and UCL Faculty of Laws, and Dr. Eden Sarid from the University of Essex School of Law.
Thank you very much, everyone, for joining this book launch today. We're really excited to have you here and have all of our wonderful commentators along with us. My name is Haim Abraham. I'm a lecturer here at the University of Essex School of Law and also at UCL Faculty of Laws. And together with Eden Sarid, who is also a lecturer at the University of Essex School of Law, we organized this book launch. So just a few notes on the way that the book launch is going to proceed. We're going to start with a very brief introduction of the book, of the commentators, and then we'll have the comments themselves, a response by Hedy, and then Q&A from the audience. So a little bit about this wonderful book, Problematizing Law, Rights, and Childhood in Israel-Palestine. Hedy will send a link in the chat for anyone who wants to purchase the book with a 20% discount. So that's a little bit of a promotional there. This is a very insightful, thought-provoking, and groundbreaking book. And it set out to unsettle and disrupt how we think about and perceive law, rights, and childhood using very impressive application of theories to a vast collection of empirical data, encapsulating hundreds of texts, cases, and hours of observations of hearings. And in my personal view, Hedy achieves what he sets out to do in this book, showing that the law isn't objective nor necessarily protective, that abstract universal categories can be used as means of domination, and that through lack of proper appreciation, even protective actors can harm children by equating legal with adequate. But more on that from our three fantastic speakers that we have today. First up, we have Alexandra Cox from the University of Essex Department of Sociology. She is an expert in criminology and youth justice, and she worked at the State University of New York and served on boards of many organizations, such as the New York State Defenders Association and Literacy for Incarcerated Teens. We also have with us Mariam Jamshidi from the University of Florida Levin College of Law, who is a leading voice in the areas of national security, foreign relations, and their interactions with private spheres. She worked at NYU Law School, leading law firms, and clerked for the US District Court Judge Gladys Kessler of the District Court of Columbia. And lastly, we have with us Yael Ronan of the Academic Center for Science and Law at the Hebrew University, who is a world-renowned international law scholar, who is also the academic editor of the Israel Law Review. Prior to academia, Yael spent a decade in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Israel and worked on the Oslo Accords. And of course, we have the man of the hour, Hedy Viterbo from Queen Mary University, London. And previously, he was a lecturer at the University of Essex School of Law and a Leverhulme Early Career Fellow at SOAS. Those familiar with Hedy's work will know that Hedy is an authority on all matters relating to childhood, state violence, and sexuality. And I think that at this point, I've spoke enough, and there's much more that could be said about the book and the speakers that we're gonna have today, but I'm gonna leave that to our wonderful commentators, starting with Alexandra Cox. So Alexandra, please take us away.
Thank you all so much for having me and for inviting me to participate in this conversation about this amazing book, which I feel really honored to have read. And I'm just coming off of a weekend celebrating my stepdaughter's 18th birthday, which brings all of its own kind of rites of passage and fetishization of childhood and adulthood, which I think Hedy nicely brings to light through his work. And I was just really excited to think about it. Forgive me for sort of reading a little bit just for a moment, but it, you know, this is a really rich book that I think, you know, needs sort of some careful thought. I really found this book a very refreshing and provocative challenge to the prevailing discourse and policy approaches to children's rights. His book raises critical questions about the uses and misuses of age-based distinctions aimed at protecting children and challenges approximately 150 years of thinking about age distinctions in criminal law. The case study of Israel-Palestine is an extraordinary and powerful way of engaging in the debate about the efficacy of children's rights, in part because of the symbolic, legal, social, and political role that Israeli and Palestinian children play in public life and debate. The reproduction and proliferation of the image of the stone-throwing Palestinian child that Hedy so powerfully interrogates in his work as what he calls a, quote, central preoccupation of the Israeli legal system is one of the most powerful examples of the ways that he takes the idea and the insidious uses of it, of the child, and challenges us to think beyond it. I wanted to start by briefly providing some information about my own background in order to frame my response to the book. Much of my work has focused on the administration of justice in the US context, with a focus on the governance of young people through punishment, but also the public policy discourses that circulate about system reform. I came to this work through my background as a sentencing mitigation specialist, representing young people and adults charged with crimes in New York's criminal courts. As I went on to do research about young people's experiences in custody and also participated in reform conversations about raising the age of criminal responsibility, I began to observe key tensions emerge between the ideas about childhood that juvenile justice advocates advanced and the lived experiences of the young people and adults I knew in custody. On the outside, advocates used developmental psychology discourses to highlight the so-called trauma that many of the young people in the system had suffered. And they argued that this trauma had created a pathway to their imprisonment. They also highlighted their developmental immaturity through an invocation of developmental neuroscience about the so-called teenage brain. What troubled me as I heard these discourses were the logics that they embedded and which similarly emerge in the Israel-Palestine context. Ideas about deserving children and undeserving adults. Links between trauma and offending that arguably perpetuate positivist thinking, and ideas about the best interests of the child being served in juvenile as opposed to adult contexts. I argue that contemporary US approaches to juvenile justice are oriented around the idea that we can isolate and discern young people's criminality and their biological and psychological makeup and act on it through the use of extensive interventions. In contrast, the lives of young people and adults in conflict with the law reflected far more complex realities. For example, in my experience, the developmental neuroscience narrative advanced by advocates that teenage offending is a reflection of a lack of impulse control and other markers of neurodevelopmental immaturity is frequently challenged by prosecutors and judges who see a young person who has committed a heinous crime as engaging in a risk that far exceeds that identified by advocates. Elsewhere, I've also pointed to the ways that the so-called trauma-informed practices in juvenile justice systems, which have been aimed at making juvenile facilities more therapeutic and rehabilitative, such as through the use of natural lighting, enhancement of living spaces, and interventions, is arguably a form of what some people have called carceral humanism, which includes attempts to kind of improve conditions of confinement, but still maintain a commitment to custody and incarceration as a solution for the social problems it reflects. I found this when I interviewed young people in a facility that had introduced trauma-informed practices, that they spoke to me about their experiences of the repressive nature of care and control. I want to focus here on three elements of Hedy's argument that resonated with what I have observed in the US context and discuss the significance of his work for the transnational study of what he calls child law and practice. One, Hedy's focus on the uses of age as a tool of security governance was a fascinating contribution to broader scholarship on future dangerousness. He highlights the ways that human rights actors and Israeli jurists invoke the future security risk of Palestinian children, ultimately justifying confinement, limitations on movement, and security-based interventions, and ultimately severe restrictions on the rights of both Palestinian children and adults. Thus, the separation of children is justified on the grounds of future risk. But as Hedy so powerfully points out, this separation justifies a host of detrimental practices that negatively affect both young people, their families, and also other adults. His argument resonated with some of my own research in the US on the construction of prisons as spaces of contagion and contamination for children. Juvenile justice advocates in the US frequently invoke the idea of contamination when advocating for age-segregated incarceration, as well as the importance of raising the age of criminal responsibility and thus keeping children under the age of 18 in juvenile facilities as opposed to adult prisons. Yet, as I've argued in some of my work on juvenile prisons, these facilities are arguably no less repressive and punitive than adult prisons. And in fact, their softer exteriors often belie their sometimes overtly sort of or obscure, sometimes their overtly repressive interiors. I think this leads to the second point in Hedy's book, which really resonated. He points to the uses of youth voice in human rights discourses aimed at promoting age-segregated treatment and incarceration. He looks at the absences and limitations of participation and questions that emerge about tokenism and youth participation in debates about age separation. He argues that, quote, despite occasionally taking the empowerment and political agency of young Palestinians into account, the dominant human rights discourse almost invariably subordinates them to the perceived victimhood, innocence, and suffering of this population. He also points to the absence of counter-narratives and narratives which reflect the complexity of young people's experiences. Sometimes young people in custody share perspectives which adult reformers don't want to hear. In New York, young people charged as adults under the state's juvenile offender law begin their time in youth custody, and then if their sentence continues past their 21st birthday, they're transferred to adult prison on that date. While I was conducting research inside of New York's juvenile facilities, a number of the young people I was meeting with, many of whom were around 18 years old and serving lengthy sentences, said to me that they wanted to move early to the adult prison before they turned 21. Their perception was that they would have more freedom in the adult prisons and more opportunities to set the pathway toward their educational development. In the juvenile facilities where they were based, the curriculum was recycled every year, the behavioral change program was rigid and ubiquitous, and daily life was highly regulated. For these young people, adult prison offered them an opportunity to get the system off their back in sort of a perverse way. Hedy points to the narratives of young Palestinians who saw the benefits they accrued from being with adults in custody, mentorship, guidance, learning, and how these narratives sit in tension with the desires of human rights campaigners. His work asks us to consider in whose best interest children's rights emerge and whose voice matters. He argues that the, quote, abstractions and claims to the universality of the child's rights discourse leads to decontextualization in the form of giving precedence to international legal norms over the particular conditions in which those classified as children live, or even overlooking those conditions altogether. I've spoken about just a few ways that his arguments resonated with my own observations in the US, in part because I think it's one of the great contributions of his work is in pointing us to the ways that transnational discourses about child protection and rights are mobilized, co-opted, and expanded, often ways that come at the cost of individuals, both young and old, at the hard end of state violence. I want to end by asking a few questions and pointing to sort of his contributions that I'd love to learn a little bit more about, which I find particularly exciting. The first is on his work on the intergenerational transmission of knowledge and intergenerational incarceration. And I think it was really interesting to me to think about how this was a kind of central counter narrative to the protectionist discourses that he was critiquing. I also felt that this was an area of the book that most contributes actually to contemporary conversations in childhood studies about how we can think about children productively. There's a recent book by the scholar Peter Kraftel called After Childhood that where he really tries to get us to think about sort of how we can think after childhood in new and innovative ways. And I'm sort of curious about how Hedy might develop this area of thinking further as a kind of really how interdependency between children and adults and thinking about age relationally can be developed as a sort of way of thinking. I'm also interested to learn more about the experiences of Palestinian adults who are incarcerated in Israel and Palestine, just really out of curiosity and interest, in part because my own work, I really think, you know, this sort of binary between adults and children can be quite dangerous. Hedy pointed to a fascinating program of political education inside, and also the kind of harms that have happened as a result of the cuts to open university courses in Israel and Palestinian the prisons. So I'm curious to learn more about the role and place of prisoner rights organizations in Israel, Palestine, particularly for adult prisoners, and if there's any scope in this work to challenge hegemonic assumptions about age. I'm also curious to learn more about how age is kind of mediated through citizenship. I grapple in my own work with the need to acknowledge the unique marginality of criminalized young people, especially in terms of their relationship to citizenship. So it's often the case that the young people that I'm thinking about are impoverished, socially excluded, and politically neglected, and that these conditions expose them uniquely to criminalization. Yet they have very little ability to change or even affect change over those conditions. I'm curious to learn more about how Hedy makes sense of this unique age-related status in the context of his work in Israel-Palestine. I'm so grateful, again, to have this chance to engage with this work. It's just really exciting to read. And I also am particularly excited to see where Hedy's work goes. And sort of, thank you. That's really it.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Adsa. This has been great. And I've highlighted a few things that I would be very happy to follow up on, maybe at the Q&A stage. But for the time being, and sake of being concise, we'll move on to our second commentator, Maryam Jamshidi. So Maryam, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Chaim, for inviting me to be a part of this important conversation, and to Hedy for spending, I don't even know how much of your life writing this book. It seems like it was an enormous endeavor, and I echo the comments from Alexandra and Haim about just the importance of what you've done here. So, I sort of wanted to start a little bit by, setting, the general sort of project of the book, right? And make sure I've understood it correctly. So I take Professor Viterbo's project as one that is specifically challenging, right? The legalism of discourses on childhood in Israel-Palestine, and that generally shows how a focus on law individualizes and decontextualizes Israeli crimes and acts of oppression against the Palestinian people. So that I think is something that hopefully we all can agree on. At the outset though, I wanna know that unlike Alexandra, I'm not an expert in any way, shape or form on child law, whether in Israel or otherwise. As Chaim mentioned, my focus is really on national security within the US context. More broadly. Nevertheless, I appreciate Professor Viterbo's effort to deconstruct and critique the category of the child and the way it has been deployed by international and Israeli law, human rights actors, and the Israeli government. In particular, I was quite convinced by Professor Viterbo's argument about how essentializing conceptions of the child of the child and childhood have framed and defined international child law, how these concepts are malleable in ways that reflect and facilitate legal and political manipulation of the concept of childhood, and make both Palestinian children and adults vulnerable to harsh treatment and repression. As Professor Viterbo notes in his book, his arguments are rooted in part in a long tradition of scholarship, critiquing law status as a scientific, rational system that is free of social, political, and economic influences. But Professor Viterbo's work is also situated within a growing body of scholarship, examining how governments, including Israel and the United States, weaponize law, especially international law, to pursue and legitimize policies that are morally reprehensible and unjust. And I'll come back to that idea later in my commentary. So I've been asked to focus on chapter 6 and 7 of Professor Viterbo's book. These are chapters that deal with quite different subjects. So chapter 6 focuses on Israel's practices of visibility and concealment when it comes to punishing, disciplining, and controlling Palestinian persons under the age of 18. Chapter 7 goes into a different direction and examines judicial and political practices of infantilization, which Professor Viterbo defines as the characterization or treatment of formerly adult individuals as children. In particular, Chapter 7 looks at how the Israeli judiciary and political actors infantilize young Israeli soldiers to mitigate and even excuse their crimes, including against Palestinians under the age of 18. Chapter 7 also examines the relationship between militarism and childhood more broadly. So specifically, it looks at how Israel manipulates the category of the child to further its military actions and avoid accountability for those policies. So for example, as Professor Viterbo explains, Israel has argued that its need to defend its children excuses its bombing of Palestinians. In attempting to justify its killing of Palestinians under the age of 18, the Israeli government has also often suggested that their status as children is diminished or irrelevant, either because they have been used as so-called human shields or served as child soldiers for groups like Hamas. Chapter 7 relatedly also shows how Israel views its own children as soldiers in the making, and how this view impacts both how children are educated in Israel and how crimes committed by Israeli Jews under the age of 18 are treated within the Israeli judicial and political system, as well as in Israeli society. So there's a lot going on there. And rather than trying to sort of meld these various themes into a set of unified comments, I want to lay out some of the reactions and questions that these chapters provoked for me. So starting with chapter 6. So as I mentioned, this chapter is about visibility, but also invisibility when it comes to Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the occupied territories. As this chapter shows, while visibility primarily in the form of real-time video footage can empower Palestinians by exposing Israel's crimes, practices of visibility are also used by Israel to subject Palestinians to a panopticon-style form of control. And I don't know if you've been following the news, but there were quite a few news reports over the last few days about some of these tactics of visibility. In his book, Professor Viterbo focuses in particular on Israel's systemic practice of photographing all Palestinians, including children, upon arrest, as well as photographing Palestinians under the age of 18, or just when they're on the streets, or even sleeping in their homes. Chapter 6 also discusses practices of invisibility or concealment, namely the ways Israel tries to conceal its crimes, including by destroying or withholding incriminating evidence of its actions against Palestinians, by torturing Palestinians through practices like prolonged stress positions that don't leave any visual marks, and through practices of state secrecy more generally. So many of these practices of visibility and concealment you describe, Professor Viterbo, are not all that different from practices undertaken by other security states, as well as resistance to those practices. So for example, in conducting its so-called war on terror, the US government has systematically utilized similar torture techniques and secrecy practices to avoid accountability. China's policies against the Uyghur minority group have involved various forms of mass surveillance and disciplining, including gathering biometric information on Uyghur individuals and placing Chinese operatives in Uyghur homes to monitor Uyghur behavior. How do you think about Israel's practices in relation to these and other forms of visibility and concealment used against vulnerable groups? Is there something you think is uniquely meaningful or important about the use of visibility and concealment in the context of Israel-Palestine? Or is it part and parcel of these other practices? In the introduction to your book, you mentioned that in sort of examining Israel's modes of control, one of your aims is to call attention to Palestinian resistance. And you mentioned a few examples like running study groups in prison, smuggling sperm of incarcerated men outside of prisons, doing reading groups in public protests. But I didn't see much in chapter six about Palestinian acts of resistance in response to Israel's pervasive surveillance system in the territories. In other words, how do Palestinians, whether children or otherwise, engage in acts of invisibility or concealment or potentially other forms of resistance to avoid the Israeli panopticon? I'd love to hear more about that if you have something to say about that. At the end of chapter six, you discuss how the privileging of real-time video evidence by both human rights organizations and the Israeli state undermines Palestinian testimony about Israeli crimes and disconnects those crimes from their broader institutional context, specifically from Israel's systemic concealment practices. You suggest this problem can be fixed by using what you call alternative visual evidence, like reenactment videos or artist depictions of detained Palestinian youth being tortured. I wonder though whether practices of Israeli concealment are at the heart of the problem that you're trying to address here. And in fact, you mentioned in chapter six that corroborating real-time video isn't actually enough most of the time to result in punishment in crimes committed for crimes committed against Palestinians by Israeli soldiers. While Israel's practices of concealment are, of course, problematic to say the least and should be addressed, I wonder if the crux of the problem, at least when it comes to the privileging of real-time video, is in fact the underlying norm that makes that those sorts of video necessary, namely the view that Palestinians are guilty until proven innocent, while Israeli soldiers are innocent until proven guilty. Should these sort of alternative forms of evidence you suggest focus more on confronting these deeper issues? If so, I'm not sure the alternatives you provide do that, but perhaps I'm missing something here. I also want to push back a bit on your argument that in privileging real-time video, the Israeli government and human rights orgs are both equally responsible for undervaluing Palestinian testimony. This ties into my last comment about the nature of the problem here. So using video to corroborate Palestinian testimony, as human rights organizations do, seems quite different from refusing to believe Palestinian testimony unless there is corroborating video evidence. Arguably, real-time video can in fact provide evidence that undermines the force of stereotypes about Palestinian guilt and Israeli innocence. So to move on to chapter six. So as I mentioned, that chapter essentially focuses on how militarism, namely the military's influence on all aspects of life, affects Israeli views on who or and who isn't a child, as well as how children, whether Israeli or Palestinian, are treated by the Israeli state. As you point out, your aim in this chapter is not to reinforce the child-soldier distinction, but instead to problematize and critique that distinction. At the heart of Chapter 7's project are two phenomena: the infantilization of Israeli soldiers that I mentioned before, all of whom are over 18, and the institutional view that all Israeli Jewish children are soldiers in the making. And I have a series of interconnected questions and observations about these points. So first, as applied to Israeli soldiers, the notion of infantilization, as you put it, quote, signals the need for familial-like love, which brings with it competing attitudes from mercy and support to tough love. How does this notion of infantilization intersect or impact, if at all, your project of deconstructing what childhood and the child mean? is infantilization nothing more than a continuation of essentializing discourses on the child? Or does it actually provide a way of rethinking the child-adult binary, albeit one that only benefits Israeli Jews and not Palestinians, at least for the time being? Relatedly, in chapter 7, you describe how the view of Israeli Jewish children as soldiers in the making influences the education they receive, as well as their treatment by Israeli judicial and political systems. Basically, Israeli children are educated, as you argue, to believe in the importance and prestige of military service. They also sometimes receive lenient treatment when they break the law in order to avoid impacting their future military service. This question is sort of similar to the last one that I had. How, if at all, do these practices also inform your project to reconceptualize the child-adult distinction? As I mentioned earlier, I'm generally in favor of your effort to deconstruct how we define and conceptualize childhood, but I was sort of left wondering about how far you're willing to take this work. So are you, for example, willing to do away with the distinction altogether? Or is your project about acknowledging childhood's place within its particular sociopolitical context? If you're in favor of doing away with the child-adult distinction, does that mean you're comfortable with eliminating all age-based distinctions, whether it comes to trying under 18s for crimes or recruiting them to the military? Or would you instead draw the child-adult distinction differently, perhaps eliminating it when it comes to legal obligations, but keeping it when it comes to rights? If you're in favor of making childhood more subjective, how do you avoid having children in different communities or countries subjected to different treatment, different rights, and different obligations as a matter of international law? Isn't this arguably what is happening in Israel-Palestine and part of the problem your book seeks to address? A related question. So in reading this chapter, I found myself thinking a lot about how the Israeli government has effectively altered the meaning of a lot of different legal concepts and mainstreamed those alternative definitions. This includes giving the concept of terrorism a new kind of normative weight and redefining who or what a terrorist is, reconceptualizing who is or isn't a combatant in armed conflict, and most recently, redefining anti-Semitism. Do you believe Israel is engaging in a similarly revisionist project when it comes to the notion of childhood? Assuming you do, is this reconceptualization good or bad? To me, it seems like it's happening on some level and is far from a good thing, at least for marginalized communities. If you agree with all that, how do we resist this reconceptualization without reinforcing the child-adult binary that you rightly challenge? So a final thought. Chapter 7 really made me think even more deeply about your point that a focus on legal rights and obligations, whether to do with childhood or otherwise, individualizes Israel's systemic violence and oppression in Israel-Palestine. Nevertheless, I continue to be a believer, as others are as well, that the so-called objective nature of law gives marginalized communities important tools for advocacy and accountability, however imperfect. Perhaps the solution to the individualization problem is for human rights orgs to explicitly and continuously situate human rights within their broader political and social context. So, for example, Israel's violations of the rights of Palestinian children ought not to be discussed in a vacuum, but rather as one part of a decades-long policy of occupation, apartheid, collective punishment, and ethnic cleansing. Again, thank you so much, Professor Viterbo, for this important book, and I look forward to the discussion that will follow.
Thank you so much, Mariam. These are all very thought-provoking questions and observations, and I really look forward to hearing some of Hadi's thoughts on them. But now, last but not least, we have Yael Ronen. So Yael, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. So I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to participate, and Hadi for writing the book. I'm Israeli, we operate on first name basis. So Hadid notes that there's extensive literature on the conduct of the military authorities in the occupied territories, either in their capacity as the executive or, to a lesser extent, in their capacity as the legislature. But there's very little literature on the practice of the judicial authorities, and even that practice, or even that literature, in which I share, actually, is largely limited to the case law of the appeals instance. But the law in occupied territory, no less than in sovereign states, is created by the massive case law of lower courts. And Hadid's contribution in bringing this case law to light is extremely important. Sadly, the picture that he paints is bleak and depressing. But the book is also an exceptional opportunity in that it offers an interdisciplinary approach. And I think the composition of the panel today illustrates this. So it's a novel contribution, and I'm grateful to be here. And for my part, I'll address what is probably the most legalistic aspect of the book. So let me start with Hadid's main assertion, and I'm quoting, that Israel neither simply erodes childhood nor disregards legal and human rights norms. Instead, Israeli authorities have pursued a more sophisticated course of action, deploying law, rights, and childhood in general, to entrench, perfect, and launder Israel's oppressive control regime. And I entirely agree with this proposition, but I reach it in a different route from Hadid's. And in what follows, I want to demonstrate this through one of the main practices that the book describes, the age criterion in sentencing and detention decisions, which are discussed in chapter 3. So chapter 3 considers the manner in which judges of the military courts apply the provision that requires taking the child's age into account in sentencing and detention proceedings. And as Hadid notes, this provision assumes that young age will serve as a mitigating circumstance. But nonetheless, in practice, judges apply this provision so that young age serves as an aggravating circumstance, holding that this is required to counter the phenomenon whereby young people are utilized by adults to carry out criminal action on the assumption that young people would be sanctioned more lightly. And at other times, judges rely on the appearance of age rather than on the known age. Now, while this disregard of the law sometimes is beneficial to defendants, even that at times has proven detrimental to them, adding another layer to the abuse of the law. And the question is, how should we understand this situation? And what is the flaw that needs to be corrected? So Hadid notes, and I quote, that human rights have all too often been applied without due sensitivity to the social, political, and even legal specificity of the context at hand. And as I understand it, Hadid criticizes the law for excessive malleability. And for my part, I would like to propose that the flaw lies not with the law, but with the law appliers. But first, I'd like to speak in defense of human rights law. It's true that human rights law is essentially non-contextual. It assumes certain needs and characteristics of human nature that are inherent to any individual, irrespective of context. These needs and interests are reflected in the notion of rights. But the structure of human rights law is that rights can and need to be balanced against each other and against sometimes overriding social interests. And that balancing is, or at least should be, context related. And therefore, it varies from case to case. Now, if administrative authorities act in disregard of that context, and if courts do not rectify this disregard, then the failure is in the system, not in the law. And indeed, my principal question to Hadid follows precisely from this critique of his. What is the alternative to human rights law or child law? Granted that not every problem should be dealt with through law to begin with, but once the law is involved, should there be no differentiation between children and adults? Should we abandon the age-based distinction that Hadid terms essentialist and developmentalist, even when modern society is grounded in it overall? And would such different law, yield a more just outcome in the case law of the military courts? My guess is not, because as I said, I think the problem lies not with the law, but in its application. And since human rights law calls for balancing of rights and interests, case-specific context is in the eyes of the decision maker, namely the judge. And this leads me to my main point of principle, the judicial function in a situation of occupation. The premise of a judicial system in a society governed by the rule of law is that when a dispute arises As to balancing conflicting rights and interests, the decision will be made by a neutral third party. In a situation of occupation, this premise fails, and I would view the practice of the military courts in that light. Judges of the occupying power, they're not disinterested third parties. I'm tying this into my own work with David Kretzmer, where we've shown and discussed this with regard to the case law of the Supreme Court of Israel. And Hadith shows the same pattern with regard to military courts. They're not neutral. Their work consists of resolving a conflict between their own political community. In this case, it's a criminal conflict. And a person who belongs to a political community that is locked in conflict with the judge's own community. And in the eyes of the judge's community, that's the Israeli community, Palestinians are, by virtue of their national identity, the enemy. Now, one aspect of this, and this comes across in the case law that Hadi describes, and also in other chapters, I'm just basically limiting myself to discussion of this chapter, is the demonization of the entire population. So Hadi's account of the case law on the age factor is a direct example of this. The judges punish young people more severely in order to deter their adult handlers. The judges assume no agency in Palestinian children, and they attribute to Palestinian adults the weaponization of their young. Now, needless to say, neither view is substantiated in the case law in any way. It's merely grounded in what Hadi rightly terms Israel's long-lived tradition. And this tradition permeates the legal system. It's also manifest in the Supreme Court's practice relating to punitive house demolitions, which Hadi also mentions. The notion that it's legitimate to inflict harm on one person in order to influence others. So in the eyes of the Israeli courts, Palestinians are just one, they're a mass. Criminal conduct implicates everyone, those directly involved, those indirectly involved, and those that are not involved at all, but could potentially be involved. So anybody can be legitimately sanctioned in order to deter. Parents are responsible for their children's actions, and children bear the consequences of the presumed acts of unknown adults. Now, the Supreme Court has not shied away from collective punishment against individuals on the basis of unsubstantiated observations on the social mores of the Palestinians as a community. And the military court, as Hadi describes, do the same thing to justify detention and imprisonment. So the military court's practice is a facet of a larger phenomenon. Domestic courts of an occupying power, the occupying power in this case, and military courts are domestic courts. They face inherent obstacles to guaranteeing the rule of law in its substantive sense when dealing with the occupied population. Whether the individuals are young people or adults, whether at issue is criminal law or public law, these are merely variations on a theme. The overriding factor is national identity. And I think Hadi and I are probably in agreement on this issue. Where we differ is that I propose to place responsibility with those applying the law rather than with the law itself. And for this reason, I found it actually rather surprising that Hadi chose to include in the book a discussion of soldiers and settler children. Now, I understand that the inclusion was intended in order to give a comprehensive picture of the law and young people in the West Bank or in occupied territory. But ironically, I think reliance on age as the point of reference in the book reflects the very same essentialism that the book criticizes. And personally, I would have found the book lacking in nothing if it was limited to a discussion of young Palestinians. Because to put it very bluntly, Palestinian children, Palestinian young people, have nothing in common with Israeli settler children and soldiers. The age similarity is immaterial, while national identity is paramount. So what must be done to bring these violations of law to an end? So the simplistic answer may be bring the occupation to an end, but that's a political answer. It's not one that I can give as a lawyer. And in any case, what until then? The Israeli public and professionals are impervious to the increasing legal injustices of occupation, I think largely because of this demonization of the Palestinian population. But it's harder to demonize children. And my hope, and I'm not very optimistic, but a little bit of optimism is required, is that Hadi's book might perhaps touch a nerve that has until now remained unmoved and perhaps reverberate with some professionals. And I'm not so naive as to hope for any grand change, but even if the smallest change takes place in the margins, then Hedy's important work would not have been in vain. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Yael. This was absolutely fantastic. And I think that we are now at the stage where it's inevitable and we have to hear Hedy's comments on all of these fantastic remarks that we had from our three wonderful speakers. So Hedy, please, without any further ado.
Thank you very much. If it's inevitable, then it's inevitable. Can I just start by really warmly thanking all of you, thanking the University of Essex, the Department of Law for hosting this event, and thanking Haim and Eden for organizing and sharing it, and to Alexandra and Mariam and Yael for really, really rich and thought-provoking comments. I've written kind of many notes, and I have some preliminary thoughts about them, which I'll share with you. And if we have time, maybe we can continue this discussion and see where it takes. So I'd like to start with two themes that kind of recurred through more than one with more than one discussant or more than one panelist. One is kind of the transnational / global aspect, which both Alexandra and Mariam touched on. And the other, broadly conceived, is the question of what's the problem and what's the solution, or what's the alternative, which I think is something that both Mariam and Yael in different ways raise. And I think what's been so helpful to me really and so gratifying is how complementary all of your different comments were. You really kind of covered a lot. So I think I'll start with the transnational / global thing, because Alexandra, you mentioned quite a lot your important work in the US context with the youth incarceration there. You asked both about the ways in which transnational discourses are mobilized and expanded, and about kind of whether there are broader global connections. And Mariam, specifically in relation to the state practices of imposing both invisibility and visibility, you were asking whether there are any parallels there in relation to state violence elsewhere. So I'd just like to touch on that briefly, because actually I've some of my previous work does deal with both issues. And Alexandra, I've had the pleasure of writing a chapter for an edited collection that she just co-edited, where I touch on some of those parallels, but I do want to expand, because in previous work, in relation to what I call generational segregation, which I touch on in chapter 4. So that is, just to clarify to all of our audience, that is a series of reforms that Israel introduced, whereby young Palestinians in Israeli custody were increasingly separated from their older counterparts, whereas previously they had mostly been incarcerated together. And my main argument is that that shift towards generational segregation was depicted as serving the best interests of the child, as being in line with international legal norms. It was heavily advocated previously by the human rights community, which in that sense was complicit in it. And I argue why in many, many respects it's harmful to Palestinians. So I just wanted to clarify that for those who haven't read the book. And certainly there are parallels there. So in my earlier work, I discussed specifically indigenous child removal in other settler colonial contexts, especially in the US, Canada, and Australia, and highlighting quite a few parallels. For example, the way in which child removal or child separation in all of across all of these contexts was presented by its advocates as a counterinsurgency measure. So that's something that all of these contexts have in common. And the way in which it was seen by the settlers or by the state as a way to clamp down or prevent adult opposition specifically. So it was a mode of governing indigenous adults or native adults or ethnic minority adults, whatever you want to call them. And more recently, Mariam, you mentioned the issue of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. In China, in the chapter I wrote for the collection edited, co-edited by Alexandra, I also link the Israeli-Palestinian case to the case of Uyghurs in China, because both in terms of state surveillance, but also specifically in relation to generational segregation, what we see there is that in addition to, we don't know how many, but potentially hundreds of thousands and even more Uyghurs and other Muslim minority adults being now placed in internment camps, their children, in order to prevent them from being influenced by those adult ideologies, and in order to create a new generation, have been placed in securitized schools where they're exposed primarily to the Han culture, which is the dominant Chinese culture. So there are certainly parallels. And in relation to state practices of invisibility and visibility, Mariam, one of my, actually two of my previous publications discuss Israel-Palestine in connection with A, the US, B, the UK, and Syria. And I show how transnationally, if we look at all of these cases transnationally, then many of the practices that you mentioned and that are mentioned in chapter six are global trends. Certainly Israel-Palestine in some respects is endlessly unique. And in other respects, we can find in it kind of parallels or commonalities with more global issues. So I think that's just a way to highlight that theme in relation both to generational segregation, which is one form of state violence through childhood and age, and also in relation to what Mariam was talking about, which is kind of governance through invisibility and conceptualizing that more globally. And I can say more about that, but that's just kind of as a hint, perhaps, in that direction. But I do want to say more about the question of what's the problem and what's the alternative, because Mariam, you raised quite a few thought-provoking questions in relation to that and try to really push me to think about them in very useful and helpful ways. And Yael also did that in thinking about whether the problem lies with the law or with those who apply it. And what is the alternative to all of that? So I'll just start for those who are really sitting on the edge of their seats by saying, I don't have a solution, but I am thinking about one, and I am hoping in future projects of finding, I don't know if I would use the word solutions, but certainly alternative models for thinking about how we can both engage with age as a factor in people's lives, and in relation to state violence and the law's role in that respect. So I'll say a bit about that. So I'll actually start with Yael, because we do have a disagreement here, Yael, in terms of who's to blame. And I think the reason I wouldn't let law, including international human rights law, off the hook so easily, is that actually if we look at the reforms, the detrimental reforms that were made by Israel and the measures that Israel has been introducing, which Israel presents as serving the best interests of young Palestinians, but actually I argue extensively are actually a more sophisticated mode of state violence. If we look at many of these measures, we see that they were, as I alluded to earlier, that they were also advocated by the overwhelming majority of the human rights community with the best of intentions. And the reason they did that is that they had a certain conception of what international legal standards require. And I'm including here both international humanitarian law and international human rights law, including specifically international children's rights law. So we can say that that was just the wrong application of the law. That's not really what the law dictates. But when you see that among these human rights actors, is the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child, UNICEF, legal scholars who I think we would regard as leading scholars in the field, we can just say, okay, it's interesting that all of them were mistaken and that there are so many commonalities in the end result that both they, for their reasons, and Israeli authorities, for their very different reasons, ended up pursuing. But maybe it does tell us something about the law. the fact that all these dominant actors interpret it in a way that they have done. And I think what it does tell us about the law is that the law is not one thing. The law is inherently, or it inherently lends itself to those applications. I don't think it's not an unusual case or a unique case of law being applied without due sensitivity to the context. I think it's kind of a test case of how law always operates. There are endless examples of that, but I think certainly Israel-Palestine is a very vivid example. And again, I'm talking in very kind of in very broad brush strokes, and those who read the book can see that the book, I hope they'll see, provides very concrete and very specific and detailed evidence. So it's not, these are not very abstract claims. I think they're very well substantiated through empirical evidence, which Mariam was perhaps alluding to when she was feeling bad for me for having spent all this time kind of doing this research. But I do want to say more about the problem and the alternatives. And Chaim, please feel free to stop me when I go beyond the allocated time. Because there were a few questions here, which I'm just having a look at my notes. I think, first of all, Yael, and I'll kind of go back and forth between Mariam's notes, comments, and Yael's comments, because I think there are some kind of commonalities there that I can build on. I think, Yael, for me, it was interesting that you said in your concluding remarks that you, maybe the solution is to end the occupation, but that is not a legal solution. I think that tells us a lot about kind of the limitations of thinking about what is a legal solution and what isn't a legal solution. Personally, I wouldn't, and I think I allude to this in the book, I wouldn't even use the term occupation, because I think it's no longer useful, because as not only I, but also others have discussed, in international legal definitions, occupation by definition is a temporary regime, and what we have in Israel-Palestine is no longer temporary at all, which is probably one of the reasons why we're seeing actors increasingly resorting to alternative terminology such as settler colonialism and apartheid, which some people might say are not as effective legally, but that again speaks to the limitations of the law, even though apartheid certainly is a legal term. Settler colonialism, we can have a discussion about that, but I think it's certainly useful and important. But I think there is a question of what is a legal solution? What does the law allow? I certainly don't think that the law is always bad. It's always problematic. I think it does allow for many, many things, but I think once used, it needs to be used very carefully, very tactically, and realizing that even tactical or strategic uses often result in non-intended outcomes, because those strategic actors don't have full control over the ramifications of their strategy, which is one of the reasons why human rights actors try to perhaps strategically draw distinctions between children and adults, and often end up serving Israeli interests, even if they didn't aim to do that. But kind of bringing into the conversation Mariam's question about how far does this project go, and how that links with what Alexandra was also talking about in terms of de-essentializing childhood, thinking about childhood in non-essential terms, I think there are a few things to do here. Certainly, of course, firstly, we need to be more attentive to the context, which I think law is not great at. And childhood as a category childhood is a universal category, so it doesn't do context very well. So when you combine law, which is built on abstractions, with childhood, which is an abstraction, a supposedly universal, a supposedly natural abstraction, what you get almost inevitably is the lack of sensitivity to context. So certainly, Mariam, to answer your question, this is part of how far the project goes, but certainly I would hope to go beyond distinctions, age-based distinctions, and the binary, the childhood-adulthood binary distinction. What that entails, I'm not sure I can say at the moment fully. That's something that I'm working on. But I think it's we need to be more fully critical of age and realize that it's not just the distinction between childhood and adulthood that makes little sense, right? Not just lumping all under 18s into one category, which basically means that half of the population in Palestine is children, right? Regardless of their circumstances, their agency, their wishes. That's problematic. But the other thing is that we also lump the other half into one category and call all of them adults, right? They have the same rights. So whether you're 18 or 93, you're in the same category. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So these two categories need to be reconceptualized in relation to adults as well, which goes back to one of Yael's comments about why settlers are part of the story here. I think this is, in many respects, the book is about those we would call adults. So in that sense, I would like to hope that it doesn't fetishize age by only focusing on children, but it does bring into the equation adults and settlers and Palestinians. I would say that settlers and Palestinians, Yael, contrary to one of the things you said they do have certain things in common in the sense that certain discourses are being applied to them, such as the mental health discourse. But obviously they're applied to them in very radically different ways. And chapter 8 actually talks about that. And I think that links with something that Alexandra asked about, how age plays out in relation to citizenship as a category. I think one thing that chapter 8 does is revisit each of the issues I discussed in relation to Palestinians, and now considering the socio-political legal status of settlers through all of those prisms. So seeing what Mariam mentioned, seeing how as a default, Mariam said that the key problem really is that Palestinians are presumed guilty, whereas soldiers are presumed innocent. So kind of seeing how that plays out in reality in relation to settlers, right? Bringing that into the story and into the equation. But the end result is really a messy story. It's not a story that can be reduced into any of these factors because reality is messy. So law is not one thing. Law is messy. It can be beneficial and it can be harmful. Settlers are not always treated in one way, right? And young Palestinians are not one thing. They don't have the same experience and they don't have the same ideologies necessarily. So hopefully the story is also complicated without obviously ignoring all these structural issues. I feel like I've left out or forgotten most of the things you've talked about because there was so much, but I'm also not sure how I'm doing with time. So Chaim?
Hedy, we'll give it another 2 or 3 minutes before we open up the floor for questions, if that's okay.
Yep. By the way, Alexandra and Mariam and Yael, if there's anything you want to respond to, please feel free to, just because I have many pages with many notes here. I'm trying to make sure I'm responding to your comments. Let's see. Mariam, I think I wouldn't fully agree with like how you characterized some of my arguments. So let me get back on some of those comments. I wouldn't, for example, say that human rights organizations are equally responsible for some of the issues you mentioned, which is, for example, prioritizing. In chapter 6 that Mariam spoke about, I criticize certain trends that both state actors and the human rights community to various degrees are to blame for. One of which is the tendency to prioritize video evidence over verbal testimonies of Palestinians. So that's one problematic trend. And the other to believe state actors' testimonies. So when you have a soldier actually admitting that they committed a certain crime, that is very strong evidence, contrary to just the victim. And I try to suggest alternative ways of countering those trends. I wouldn't say that human rights actors, and certainly not Palestinians, are equally to blame for that. I hope what I'm showing throughout the book is that these actors are not equally complicit. They're not equally anything, but there are many more commonalities in their discourses and their blind spots than we usually tend to think. I think the common picture we have, and it's certainly borne out by media coverage, including recent media coverage of how Israel just labeled certain Palestinian human rights organizations as terrorist organizations, we can see why we would have a mental image of these two as opposite camps, right? Israel versus the human rights community. I certainly think that these two camps, if we want to call them that, they would like to perhaps sometimes think of themselves as opposing camps. But in practice, what we see that is that they build on very similar discourses and notions, including some of those all three of you mentioned in your comments, such as, I think it was Alexandra that mentioned kind of the image of young Palestinians as a security threat. So that's something that human rights actors also use that trope, although I do have to say it's mostly Israeli human rights actors, and I mentioned that. So I wouldn't say that they're equally to blame, but they do have, I think, some thinking to do. They have, I think there's a need for more nuance here and more cautiousness in terms of their use of childhood and legal norms. And so hopefully there are some lessons to be learned about that. I also wouldn't say, Mariam, that when I talk about alternative evidence and their and the potential of alternative evidence, so rather than putting all the hope in, for example, video evidence, kind of looking at what alternative evidence can offer, such as Palestinian children reenacting the violence that they were subject to, I'm not claiming to fix the problem, which I think was the word you used, but I'm just trying to kind of engage with this issue in a way that is not limited to dominant state views. But I'm not fixing the problem. I think it's not a problem we can fix, really, but it's a problem that we need to address differently. Similarly, and this is something that Yael and Mariam, I think, touched on, and as you can see, I'm trying to kind of connect some of the threads here to speak in terms that are more like meta. Similarly, I think there's certainly a need to politicize the debate, to contextualize kind of legal questions without, and I think that's something that Yael, you talked about, kind of explicitly politicize, not be afraid to be political about this, because the law is political, so we shouldn't pretend it isn't, and make it explicitly political and be honest about the fact that the law doesn't really say any particular thing. It says a multitude of different things, and kind of be honest about that and utilize that as part of a broader, overtly political, unapologetically political conversation, whereby legal concepts and supposedly non-legal ideas are simultaneously utilized strategically and unapologetically. But what that means concretely, I think, really depends on the context. So I wouldn't be able to provide like a plan in advance that would cover, conveniently for me, that would cover all possible scenarios. But that's a conversation I'd be happy to continue kind of thinking about what that actually entails.
Well, thank you so much to our outstanding commentators and to Hedy for what I thought was a truly thought-provoking and super interesting discussion. And I think this discussion only reflects how rich and novel and interesting this wonderful book is. And this truly kind of, interdisciplinary discussion brings up a lot of questions. So a little bit about how the Q&A is gonna work. Anyone in the audience who wishes to ask a question, all you need to do is use the raise hand function. And I will just let you speak. If you prefer to type your question in the Q&A or in the chat, that's absolutely fine as well. And as you think of your questions and write them down, if I can just start, abuse my role as moderator here and just make a few short questions to our three panelists. Reflecting a little bit on what Hedy was saying as he was replying to your very thoughtful comments. So Alexandra, I found the concept of age mediated through citizenship a very rich and interesting concept. And how, if you could please tell us a little bit more about that and what you mean by that and maybe how it applies in particularly the context of Israel slash Palestine. Mariam, if you could tell us a little bit more about what might be a tension, I think Hedy mentioned that as well, between justice and in particular cases versus kind of uniform application of the law. And Yael, my question to you was, is whether we could really detach the law from those who apply it. And if we do that, aren't we letting the rule of law off the hook a little bit in that regard? So I'd love to hear your reflections, and I'll wait for the questions in the Q&A. Again, just use the raise hand function. Alexandra, why don't we start with you according to the same sequence that we used earlier?
Sure, thank you, Eden. That's a really cool question. I guess I think about this in two ways, and Hedy's book made me think about it another way. But so I guess that I've always thought about young people, there's a concept of sort of citizens in waiting that young people in conflict with the law are in this peculiar place of vulnerability because they've been criminalized for many reasons related to, you know, sort of forms, as I said, sort of forms of social exclusion and political exclusion and racism and all of these kinds of social forces. But they also are in a position where the very laws that shape and policies that shape these patterns of criminalization are laws which they have no ability to participate in many cases if they're below the age of 18. So I've always kind of grappled with what that means for, as someone who's kind of like a bit tries to be anti-essentialist in my own thing, like how that can also be helpful for the way that we think about young people's unique relationship to citizenship. But I felt that actually, like Hedy's book made me think, well, there's also a question of national identity too. And I really felt like your treatment of the kind of different status of the sort of the Palestinian in East Jerusalem as opposed to the Palestinian in the West Bank and the Palestinian in Gaza and the Israeli settler sort of raised questions for me about how we can think about those intersecting issues of national identity, but also citizenship vis-a-vis age. And I don't really have any answers, so I don't know if I'm not, but that was kind of what I was just sort of curious to hear more about from Hedy, like age, what is that other relationship to sort of age as political participation as well? And does that make sense a little bit more? Yeah.
Thank you, Maria.
So your question is a pretty big one. I don't have, you know, a specific child, well, you know, a sort of Israel-Palestine specific child law example. I think Hedy provides sort of an overarching argument for how, you know, potentially objective applications of, you know, what is or isn't a child in Israel-Palestine, well, A, aren't ever objective, but B, to the extent that they are, that they often have unjust consequences, especially for Palestinians. But, you know, just to think of a couple of examples from sort of the areas of law I work on, I mean, you can obviously look to laws that are themselves problematic, right? So there's this concept of material support that is also, I think, very familiar to Israeli law scholars. It's very embedded in the United States. It's a very problematic concept. It's incredibly broad. And, you know, its application often has very troubling consequences. So, you know, because of its malleability, you can be on the hook, for example, for giving food to somebody who is affiliated with a terrorist organization. And that's an objective application of the law. And it carries with it enormous prison sentencing. You know, in tort law, which I work on as well, and I know Chaim does too, you know, when it comes to, you know, principles of negligence, things like mental disability, at least in the United States, are not taken into consideration. So the mental disability of a person accused of an act of negligence isn't going to be taken into account. You'd think that that would be something that would be relevant, right? tort law has sort of different, goals perhaps and sort of criminal law, but nevertheless, like, you know, there are conceptions of justice that work there as well. So those are just a few examples. I think, you know, if you gave me and 24 hours, you know, an endless sheet of paper, I could probably come up with a lot more just by Googling it. But those are just some that come to mind. There are just, I think, endless examples.
Great. Thank you so much, Mariam. Yael, last question was to you.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure I know how to answer this. You're asking whether we can distinguish it with something, detach the law from its appliers. I think the law does have a separate existence from the way it is applied. I am not a relativist. I don't think anything can be reduced to it's whatever you make of it. For example, you know, the provision on taking age into account, I don't think that the fact that the law does not explicitly say it must be a mitigating circumstance and never an aggravating one, the fact that it's not there makes it malleable. I think it's because the law has some objective meaning that we can speak about abuse of the law. And in that sense, yes, I think we can detach. I don't think that because it's abuse, because there's abuse of the law, then the law is by definition meaningless. And attest that I'm a positivist and I'm much more conservative than Hadi. He will bring change much faster than I will, and I accept that. But you know, you need the sounding board. I think another example, and in fact, I also wanted to say something about Chapter 4 and the issue of segregation in prison and in detention facilities. The idea of the benefit of the best interest of the child. Now the thing is, I'll concede there is a problem with applying international human rights law in a situation of occupation. I think the problem is that human rights law assumes a democratic society where, you know, I said it's the judge's role to be neutral in applying balancing rights and interests, but the determination of what are the legitimate rights, well, the rights are easy, but what are the legitimate interests that may justify the rights? That's a political decision for a community to make. And the assumption is that the people that are subject to those restrictions are the ones benefiting from them, potentially benefiting from them. That's not the situation in a situation of occupation. The population has, I mean, by definition, in a situation of occupation, the population has no role in determining what the values are and what would justify restrictions. So there is a problem there. I don't think that, and which is why I think we do need to speak about the situation of occupation. And I don't want to get into a whole debate, because I'm not sure this is the place for it, is of how should we define the situation. I think the problem with saying this is no longer a situation of occupation, but colonialism, settler colonialism, is that we don't have a set of norms of how should colonialism be applied, because colonialism would be unlawful. And then that should, you know, then the lawyer would say, bring that situation to an end. But so long as the framework that is applied by everybody is the situation is one of occupation, albeit a prolonged one, temporary but indefinite, that's the then if we're talking about the law of occupation, then we need to use the norms that apply in a situation of occupation. But just to say something about the segregation, to push back a little what Hadi said, the idea that children should be protected from adults in situation of incarcerations, I think that's an interest of the child. I accept that in a certain situation, they might not be the best interest of the child, because there might be other conflicting interests that, for example, in a situation of occupation where both the adults and the young people belong to a community that the authorities regard as the enemy. And that's where the opposition is, rather than between children and adults. That's something that needs to be taken into account. And it may be that in a situation of imprisonment in occupied territories, or not necessarily in the territories, but of the population of occupied territories, the best interest of the child might not be segregation. But I have to say that the analogy to the residential schools and other examples that he gave, I don't really understand that, because incarceration of segregation of young inmates from adult inmates is that's not, I don't think this is how the heritage and culture and language are undermined. It's not the same as separating children from their parents and communities for a much lengthier period of time. I don't think prison is where children are expected to be, is the environment, neither in the best and definitely not in the worst of times, the place where children are to be socialized into their community. So denying them the influence of the adults in a situation of incarceration, I don't see why this is what undermines the cohesion of the cohesiveness of the society. So I found that comparison quite problematic. Without belittling any of the difficulties of children being incarcerated for whether shorter or longer period of time, I just don't think that that is where the problem is. And one final thing is that, and I realize I did not exactly answer your question, Aidan, but you know, I'm entitled to deflect. One last thing is just to clarify, I think that Israelis and Palestinians have a lot in common. I just think that the legal discourse and other discourse is one that is based entirely in national identity rather than on those commonalities. So that I'm saying that as a matter of fact, rather, I'm not saying that is not how it ought to be. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Just a reminder, if you have any questions, please use the raise hand or the chat function. Chaim, I know you had a question, so the floor is yours.
Perfect, thank you very much. So one thing that I wanted to maybe press Adi about a little bit was one of the themes that was identified that all of the commentators more or less raised in different forms and maybe given a slight twist with the particular focus that Yael pointed out too. And that goes to what might be the alternative that we're probably envisioning here. So we have a problem with the law, or as Yael says it, we don't have a problem with the law, we have a problem with its application. Perhaps we have a problem with the dichotomy or the way that it's being utilized and weaponized. And I think that at least from my experience in an entirely different field, but with some overlap. So in tort law, there is a particular dichotomy where you have complete immunity from injuries that were inflicted during combat, whereas for injuries that were inflicted during something that is different, then liability could be imposed on Israel. But over the years, you can see that Israel expanded that exception and basically blurred the line between war and peace, between combat and policing, and to a degree where there is no exception anymore. The exception is the rule. There is basically no liability for losses that Israel inflicts on Palestinians in the West Bank, let alone in the Gaza Strip. And one of the problems that we have here is that the law was shaped, not only applied, but shaped by actors who are from the Ministry of Justice, who are from the State Attorney Office, who are politicians, who are combatants, and they're all in constant flux and connections and relations with one another. They're not really detached. And I think that was one of the things that jumped to me when I read your book, that you said that the judges who sit in these hearings often, if not always, come from the ranks of the military advocacy system. So they prosecute minors and adults, and then a few months or years afterwards, they sit there as judges. And so that really brings into sharp focus Yael's point about the problem, not just with the law, but with the people who apply the law, where you see that there is no real separation between them. So if you add to that the problems that are inherent with the idea of an occupying force sitting in judgment over the occupying population. And you add to that the interconnectedness between the various actors, so they're able to shape the law, not just apply the law. We're in this very problematic situation where it might not be relevant whether we have a dichotomy or not. We're going to end up with the same bad result. So I was wondering if you think that this very bleak outlook that I'm now portraying is something that you think, or is this something that you share, or do you think that I need to be a bit more optimistic, or maybe I should be much more pessimistic?
Eddie, the floor is yours.
My turn? Okay. no, I'm just writing down all of these really interesting questions. And myself shifting between pessimism and optimism. A few thoughts. So thank you again, all of you. I don't want, I'll go back and forth again a bit, and Eden, please stop me when I'm going beyond the allocated time. I think I'll try to link, even though Chaim and Yael kind of approach this from a different from different angles, I do want to link a couple of things both of you said. Namely, Yael, you talked about how human rights law is supposed to be or meant for a democratic society. So that's the problem with Israel-Palestine. And Chaim similarly talked about how some of the, or part of the problem there is the professional trajectory of those who become the judges who decide what happens to Palestinians. And Chaim also described how, as he puts it, Israel has eroded certain legal distinctions between peacetime and war and so forth. Maybe some would say childhood and adulthood, which alludes also to something that Mariam asked about earlier, which is whether Israel's erosion or a redefinition of childhood is part of a broader trend of redefining other concepts. So I want to touch a bit of that. I think we should be careful not to assume that there was a golden age in which peacetime and war, childhood and adulthood were separated. I think maybe that golden age existed in our mind. I don't think historical research would support that notion. And there's some interesting research, for example, on child combatants, which calls into question the assumption that there's this old form of wars in which there was a clearer separation between children and adults in terms of who should be fighting the wars. Because some of the human rights discourse repeatedly makes this assumption, so it's not supported by historical and anthropological research. So that's just, I think that's crucial for our understanding of how law and politics work, because if there wasn't such a golden age, then that means that what we're seeing now is not entirely a new phenomenon. And it's also, even though it plays out in very extreme ways in Israel-Palestine, it's not unique to Israel-Palestine entirely. So I'm thinking here, for example, Yael, just touching on some of the things you mentioned, I was thinking about something from a different context outside Israel-Palestine, which many have written about, and Mariam is certainly very familiar with, and I've touched on in my work, which is how the US, some would say, redefined torture, others would say defined torture during its so-called war on terror, in relation to Guantanamo and black sites and other detention facilities, whereby what we had in the US is administration lawyers writing the so-called torture memos, in which they argued, using legal arguments, that if you look at the definition of torture in the UN Convention Against Torture, and that's a treaty that categorically prohibits using torture, they invoked that legal instrument and just found ways to argue that what they were doing were just enhanced interrogation techniques rather than torture. So the law, according to human rights actor in this instance, is categorical and kind of unequivocal about its prohibition of a certain practice. And yet, because legal language specifically and all language broadly are open to competing interpretations endlessly. As much as you try to be precise, there's always the opportunity to interpret the law and utilize it in a certain way. If you really want to be creative, that's part of the problem. And it's also part of the potential of law. I think that's that example tells us why what we're seeing here is not entirely unique to this situation, but rather how there's a broader lesson here to be learned about what the law enables. And again, it's the question of whether it was those who applied the law or the law itself. But I think that's again where human rights actors enter into the equation, and we see how they too push or interpret the law in problematic ways. So that's the same issue, not to mention the concept of the best interests of the child, which by definition always invites competing definitions, right? And I think we always believe that our definition or our interpretation is the correct one, obviously, let alone as lawyers, and somehow the other side's definition or interpretation is just a misapplication, but that says something about our psychology rather than about the law, I would argue. And Yael, just to go back to what you were saying about indigenous child removal, just to clarify, I wasn't saying that these instances are the same. And that article, for those who are interested, it's a 65-page long article. So I think I make that argument in great detail, but I'm not arguing that they're similar, these cases, but rather it's an analogy. So an analogy draws parallels between situations that are different rather than similar. That's the definition of an analogy. And what I show there that there are important differences, of course. For example, Israel doesn't want to assimilate Palestinians into its society, of course. So it's very different from indigenous child removal, but there are also crucial parallels that tell us something about power relations and childhood and how that's utilized, and perhaps about settler colonialism and kind of modes of governance and so forth. That doesn't erase the vast differences. The length of removal, for example, Yael, in some of these other countries was very short. It wasn't always that they were removed for years and years. It varied considerably. So I could say more about that. I do agree with you that these are very importantly different situations between themselves, not only in relation to Israel-Palestine. I'll just, Eden, briefly if I can. I think I've touched on a few issues. I just want to go back to one thing that Alexandra asked about earlier, which I wasn't able to respond to, which is about like alternative visions of childhood. You asked Alexandra about that. So, and you mentioned some writing about intergenerational and kind of relational dimensions. I certainly think, and there's a lot of promising writing, not only by Crafter, but by others as well, about thinking about intergenerational justice, intergenerational solidarity, and how generation is really key to our thinking about politics. And I think it's interesting to me, some of us define ourselves as childhood scholars or children's rights scholars, but I think childhood is so central to understanding society and politics. And we see that in Israel-Palestine, where again, half of the population is legally defined as childhood, and the other half is intimately and extensively governed through the category of childhood. So I think certainly intergenerational solidarity is part of politically reimagining what society can look like. And I think that's part of what imprisoned Palestinians were trying to do, which is what Israel tried to put an end to. And we can see that if we look at these Palestinians' own accounts. If we really kind of read them carefully, they themselves speak about, and their actions speak about, the importance and how empowering intergenerational interactions, especially in that site, which is supposed to kind of limit their political power, but actually they were able to somehow overcome it and unite and overcome intergenerational barriers, how that plays out in that context. So, yeah, I think I kind of addressed some of the points. Thank you again.
Well, I think it's time to conclude this amazingly interesting discussion. I want to, again, thank Chaim for co-organizing this with me, and thank Yael, Alexandra, and Mariam for wonderful comments. and thank Hedi for this magnificent book. A reminder, in the chat, there is a link to the book. You can buy it online with a discount. And I invite everyone to join me in thanking everybody for this wonderful panel today.